I think that door is closing. Oh, you're teasing me. All right, well, you know, this is just the beginning part, so I'll get started anyways. Good morning, everyone. This is OSP 321. If you check under your chairs, there's a set of bongo drums. We're going to teach you how to play the bongo. No, this is Active Directory integration with Office 365. This is Ross Adams, and I'm John Aluck, and we're both program managers with the Windows Azure Active Directory team. So what are we going to talk about today? We're going to cover the architecture for Office 365. I'll start by sort of letting you know right now, you're going to see us interchange the term Office 365 with Windows Azure AD a lot. That really just has to do with the nature of the platform itself and the services like Exchange, SharePoint, and Link that you know and love. We'll talk a bit about your integration options, how you can integrate with the Windows Azure AD platform, how to plan for directory integration, and then we'll dive into some of the details around the single sign-on experience for users and admins, how single sign-on actually works, so we'll talk about client access filtering, the actual flows of authentication and authorization, and finally touch on some of the options for strong authentication. We've been getting a lot of questions around that, so we figured it's about time to formalize some of that content for you. So, Windows Azure Active Directory. What does this give you? It gives the admins a way to control password policies for customers and users that have what we call cloud accounts or managed accounts. Some of the options you get is that you can set passwords to never expire. So users that log in directly to the cloud, you can say, set this particular user's password to not expire over the course of time. By default, we set a certain requirement for the strength of your user's passwords. I can't remember the exact set, but it's in our service description. You can actually set it such that users can have what we call a weaker password than that. So you can step down on the requirements, on the character set and length of that password. And you can also now configure what we call custom password policies. So you can determine how frequently user passwords are going to expire. I believe the default is 90 days right now. And you can change that to be whatever is appropriate for your company. And you can also set how frequently and how much ahead of time your users get notified that their password's about to expire. That's definitely one of the things that a lot of customers have been asking for, right? Let me know ahead of time when my password's going to expire so I can go and update that. Windows Azure Active Directory also provides, should you choose, what we call single sign-on, using your company's corporate credentials. Your users are able to use their username and password to sign into Office 365 services just like they would sign into anything or an application you have in your on-prem network. And finally, we offer what we call role-based administration. Any user that you're going to create in the cloud via the variety of integration options we're going to talk about can be assigned roles. So you don't have to give this huge, all-encompassing administrative role. We do have that. We call that a global administrator. So you can modify any of the attributes and configurations in Office 365. But you can also give more granular sets of permissions. For example, billing administrators, a user account admin, so this admin focuses primarily on administrating user accounts. A help desk admin, for example, for providing support to the users in your company as needed. And the five top admin roles are listed right there. Switching tracks a little bit, we look at integration in sort of two ways. There's what we call provisioning, getting information into the cloud. And then there's your identity or your single sign-on experience, which is focused primarily around authentication for use of your services. In terms of provisioning, we have three classes of solutions that you can take on. The first is what I like to call manual. This is the web-based, the portal page that lets you type in the username, the display name, and then sort of the basic information about your user set. If you've used the portal before, you may also have seen a bulk upload where you can provide a CSV to do en masse what you otherwise would have had to type in for each individual user in the portal. This is really for sort of our smaller customers, when you don't have a lot of users you need to input. And more importantly, that data for the user, once set, doesn't really change a lot over time. For example, how likely is your display name, your first name and last name, to change over the course of your employment? Right? Those are the attributes you can set and configure using the manual means of provisioning. The second category that we offer is what I call scriptable, meaning you can automate this to a certain extent with some scripts, PowerShell, or some custom code. We offer two real simple ways for doing this. The first is through the PowerShell module. Right now it's called the PowerShell module for Office 365 or Windows or Microsoft Online.
PowerShell module for Microsoft. We wanted something short and snappy,
yes.
So we call it the PowerShell
Windows
module.
Windows PowerShell module for Microsoft Online Services. I should know that. I own the thing. So using that, you can use the new MSOL user commandlet, for example, to create your users. You have a little bit more in terms of what you can configure. You can set the UPN explicitly. Some of the password policies are available as well. And you've probably heard, if you went to Stuart Kwan's session yesterday morning, and there's also a session on Thursday, about our new REST-based API. We're calling this the Azure AD Graph. And that gives you, a bit more control, for example, over PowerShell even, as to what properties you can set on the user. And that's definitely a route we want our partners and ISVs to start looking at to manage objects in the directory. The key difference here between this one and the manual and what we call automated is you still only have access to a limited set of the attributes for those users. For example, who here is sort of in an enterprise that has a manager hierarchy maintained in Exchange so I can see who's boss and so on and so forth? Great. That type of information is available here at the scriptable level through the graph, for example. I can see who this person manages and who they're managed by. But, for example, the manual, the portal, or the upload doesn't give you that type of control. Now we step up into what we call automated. And this is the full-fledged synchronization, directory synchronization solutions that we offer. Here actually is already on Office 365 and using DirSync, as we call it. Okay, actually a fair chunk. So as you guys and gals know, DirSync automatically synchronizes all the information you need for Office 365 from your on-prem AD up into the cloud. One of the key benefits of using a directory synchronization solution versus the portal, the manual version, or PowerShell or REST is we give you what we call delta sync, meaning I've baselined all that information up there once, and I'm only going to spend time updating the things that have changed over some period of time. And the other thing that our automated directory synchronization solutions do is they're optimized for large data sets. For example, Microsoft has 120,000 user objects and about 800,000 directory objects. That's what this tool was built for. It's automatically taking care of all that information for you. All you have to do is technically click 11 times and you're up and running. And finally, directory synchronization solutions give you access to all of the attributes on your users, contacts, and groups that can be controlled by you as the admin. Sorry, I'm pacing back and forth because there's a segment of folks that I can't see because of this monitor, so I'm just moving here. So talk a bit about the architecture and integration options. What you see here on the screen is effectively the cloud, the Windows Azure Active Directory cloud, and our associated services. As we've mentioned before, there's an admin portal, or a PowerShell interface. That's the manual and the scriptable interfaces to get your information into, ultimately, the directory store. That information eventually moves down into the different subscriptions and services that you've purchased. So, what are the three sets of integration options that you really have? Well, the first is you don't have any integration. Using that manual approach, you go to the portal page, and you just create those users directly. So there is no real connection with your on-prem directory at all. The information you create flows down into only those services that you're paying for, by the way. It's a question we get a lot. We don't arbitrarily flow your data all around the globe. It only goes where necessary based on what you've subscribed to. Second option you get is you're only going to integrate your directory data. So picture a customer called Contoso. They have their on-prem Active Directory. By setting up the directory sync tool, the thing you download from our portal, the information from that on-prem AD is synchronized up, eventually into the directory store, and as appropriate, into each of the services you've subscribed for. You'll notice that there's another giant purple box in there called the authentication platform. That's ultimately where we keep the identity information required, facilitate your users' logins as appropriate. And Ross will definitely dig into that a little bit more in the context of authentication and single sign-on. The third option is you have your directory integration and you offer your users single sign-on. In this particular configuration, you're still using directory synchronization, so you're still getting the goodness out of automated provisioning and the management of your user objects. But you've also added, and sorry, this is the top peach colored box, Active Directory Federation Server 2.0, often referred to as ADFS. This is an on-prem component that allows the Windows Azure Active Directory as a service to allow your company to manage the actual authentication experience for your users. And we'll dig into what that actually means, I think, in the next slide. Or maybe the slide after this. So, why would you want to integrate your directories and offer single sign-on to your users? So, fundamentally, one of the biggest wins for an admin is it makes your management experience easier. You're able to affect change in both your on-prem directory and your cloud in a single place, in your local on-prem directory. So users, contacts, and groups, and even security groups in Office 365. SharePoint Online allows you to use security groups to ACL documents, sites, and libraries now. All that can be managed from your single local AD. And with the directory synchronization solutions we have, that flows up to the cloud automatically. You're able to control and manage your passwords from a single place. So your users are setting passwords against your local ADs, and that information is kept there. That's a big win for some customers. And you're also managing your password policies centrally as well. The policies you've defined for your forest and domain are what apply to the credentials your users are accessing your online services with. Again, in some enterprise and customer cases, that's really desirable. SSO integration gives you true enterprise single sign-on. And the way I like to say this is your users don't even know that they've signed into the cloud. It's all happening behind the scenes. If you've done SSO right, that's really what that comes down to. And Ross is going to talk a lot more about how that magic actually works. Directory integration also gives you the opportunity to light up what we call a hybrid deployment. So picture, you're onboarding into Office 365, you have Exchange on-prem, and over time you want to move mailboxes. Maybe at first that's your IT department, and then it's going to be your HR, and the last to go are legal and your CEO level folks, right? You want to stage that migration, but still have full fidelity of Exchange features as if they were sitting side by side in your Exchange deployment on-prem. But that's what the hybrid deployment does. It makes your users believe that everything is in one place. Behind the scenes, it's all about directory synchronization, flowing information back and forth to facilitate that experience. And over time, you're going to see more of these scenarios light up. SharePoint, Link, all of these services are learning and realizing the potential about allowing customers to have deployments in two places. And so directory integration is the way to ensure that those features are going to be able to light up over time. And finally, using SSO integration, you have various options for strong authentication. For example, a lot of companies, like Microsoft, use smart cards for a second factor of authentication. And that's available to you when you set up ADFS. So I'm just going to put all these out there. Just looking then at sort of the three options we talked about in terms of pros and cons. The first, no integration. Again, this is for smaller organizations that may not even have Active Directory on-prem. You may want Azure AD to be your directory. Then that's a perfect option for you. There's no requirement for having any additional hardware in your network. You're just directly using that portal, uploading via CSV, getting that information into the cloud. And you'll see the pros grow and the cons shrink as you kind of move from left to right. So the cons are, you won't be able to get single sign-on. Without that on-prem directory and that ADFS footprint, single sign-on just isn't possible. And as an extension of that, you won't be able to light up two-factor authentication if that's something your customer is interested in. Users have two sets of credentials. So I've got my username and password to log into my corporate intranet. And now I've kind of got this second set of credentials that I use to access Office 365. Users might be able to try and change their passwords at the same time to make it as similar as possible, but it is very apparent to that user that I've got two sets of credentials I have to worry about. the ones for my on-prem directory, and the ones for the cloud. So the middle column, directory only, this is really moving into the medium to larger organizations, customers that have Active Directory on-prem. As I talked about previously, this gives you the goodness of administering all your directory data in a single place, in your on-prem AD. And you're able to light up that hybrid deployment that I was talking about, staging your Exchange migration over time. And that actually also allows you, for example, to, as you're migrating folks up, if there's some reason you want to pull someone back down from the cloud, having that hybrid deployment enabled facilitates that. So people are able to move back and forth as appropriate over the duration of your migration to Exchange Online. The cons are kind of a subset of before. You do need a single machine to deploy the directory sync tool. We install the SQL for you. If you have more than 50,000 objects, we recommend you have a separate SQL server. That's just because of the limitation of the SQL Express engine that we install by default. But in the simplest case, 11 clicks, one machine, and you're now integrating your directory data. And finally, the full-blown solution, directory integration and single sign-on integration. This is for what we usually we think of as our larger enterprises, right? Customers that have consistent churn. Great examples of customers here are folks that are companies that hire sort of seasonal workers, you know, back to school sales, things like that. You don't want to have someone have to push 4,000 new users in on, you know, Saturday morning and pull them out 3 weeks later. That should all just happen by virtue of you managing your on-prem Active Directory. And that's what directory integration gives you here. Not only that, those users you've just added get to sign in using the credentials you set for them in your on-prem directory. You don't have to worry about these 4,000 users or X thousand users, right? Having two separate credentials, having to go and find them and remove them from the cloud. Because it's managed in your on-prem AD, it's all just one task, and it automatically flows up. So the pros are single sign-on with your corporate credentials. Your identities are mastered on-prem. Password policies, like we said before, are all defined and managed by your local Active Directory. You now have two-factor authentication options available to you. You can require that smart card or some other form of authentication for login for administrators or whatever user group you decide. Again, wholly defined by your AD configuration. You get the goodness of those hybrid scenarios we talked about, and you get location isolation. What we will touch on later is, in order for ADFS to be a bulletproof solution for you, you do need to have high availability of your servers, meaning you have to consider, well, what if one of my boxes goes down, I have to load balance and such. But we'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. Okay. So now pretend I've convinced you you are going to integrate your directories and you want single sign-on. So now that you've decided to do all that goodness, let me tell you a bit about what you actually need to do it. At a bare minimum, we need an ADFFL, or forced functional level, of 2003. That's just a requirement of the directory synchronization tool and ADFS. You need to deploy ADFS 2.0 on a Windows 2008 machine. Again, just a requirement of the technology itself. Directory synchronization is a little bit different, and here's why. So, you need to install the DirSync tool on a box that's running Windows 2003 or later. And I'm going to sort of break that out to say, you actually should, just from here on out, think Windows 2008 or later, 64-bit OSs only. We have a 32-bit, and we have a 64-bit version of the DirSync tool. We're deprecating the 32-bit. So DirSync needs to be installed on a 64-bit OS. But that's different than where DirSync reads its data from. As we talked about before, DirSync can read its data from any AD that's running an FFL of 2003 or higher. So that's why I wanted to call that out, because there's kind of two different requirements in terms of what DirSync requires. Both of these components support virtualization. So if you're running any of the Microsoft or, you know, the industry products for virtualizing machines, fully supported, not a problem there. Keep in mind, though, if you're trying to make a highly available deployment, you probably don't want to host both of your VMs on the same physical host. It doesn't buy you a lot if that box goes down. And in general, the majority of our deployments are single forest deployments, meaning I have a single AD forest that all my data directory is coming from and all my users live in. So my DirSync is running against that single forest, and the ADFS authentication is running against that. We do offer multi-forest support through what we call a premier engagement. Best way to get more details about that is contact your account manager. They have all the information necessary to get you guys up and running and for multi-forest synchronization and authentication using our technologies. So, now, how do I prepare for directory integration and single sign-on? The first most important thing is make sure you have a solid design for how you're going to deploy ADFS. Why? If you're now federated, if your users are logging in using a single sign-on, your machines go down, no one's signing into Office 365. It's super important that you have a solid design, a load-balanced front, right, for your extranet, so folks at home, inside your corporate network, everyone has uninterrupted access to all of your services. Because ideally, you're now running mission-critical applications, right, and processes with things that are in the cloud. So must have a good, solid solution for how you're going to deploy ADFS. I'll kind of put a sub-point there. People often ask, well, what about directory sync? Do I need to make it highly available? What happens if I don't? Depends on who you are and how you look at this. My take on it is directory synchronization does three things for you. It creates those new users in the cloud. It deletes users that have been deleted in your on-prem directory. And it keeps those users up to date somewhere in between those two points. If you've got single sign-on, it doesn't matter if that user was deleted right away because you've blocked them already from signing in because they no longer exist in your on-prem directory. They can't sign in, period. So you're covered from that angle with single sign-on. If my display name goes stale, if someone gets married and changes their last name, whether that's mission-critical data or not, you know, that's really up to you. But the real implication of DirSync going down is new users aren't provisioned, right? I have a delay in getting new mailboxes spun up, or name changes aren't propagating as quickly as we would hope. And finally, like I mentioned before, users aren't being deleted. The last one is usually what I categorize as sort of the most risky, right? If I've just let someone go, I don't want them to access my cloud resources anymore. With single sign-on, that's not a concern. So I'll kind of leave it up to you, how you feel about directory sync and high availability. Every user must have a user principal name. Why? That's how they log into the cloud. So I, for example, at my UPN is set to a certain value. That's what I'm going to type in when I sign into my on-prem, and also what I would automatically use, and how I'm identified in the Office 365 services. One of the peculiarities of DirSync is how we handle UPN values. There's two main things that we often hit, and I want to just dive into those a little bit. The first one is, in your on-prem AD, the user principal name value can be anything. It doesn't even have to be a valid SMTP address. We do require that the UPN suffix for your UPN, well, first of all, it has to be an SMTP formed address. That's the bottom line. But the UPN suffix part, so if it's joe@contoso.com, contoso.com needs to match one of the verified domains that you have in the Office 365 service. So through the portal, you can verify domains with the service. That's what I mean. It needs to match one of the domains listed in that section. If you don't, what you're going to notice is users that are using a non-verified domain will automatically have the UPN subbed out as we synchronize up into the cloud. So joe@contoso.com on-prem, contoso.com is not a verified domain. When Joe shows up in the cloud, it's going to say something like joe@contoso.onmicrosoft.com. Where the latter part of it is really what we call the initial domain, that domain that you signed up with right at the very beginning of your admin experience. Don't worry, that's fixable, but just wanted to let you guys know that, guys and gals know that, because we do get some customers confused. Why do my UPNs look different? This isn't even a domain I know about. We do have restrictions on the characters that are allowed for user principal name. We allow letters, numbers, and here we go. Dot, dash, underscore, exclamation mark, pound, caret, and tilde. There's one qualification for the dot. You can't actually have the dot immediately preceding the at sign. So if it says ross.adams@microsoft.com, you're golden. If it says ross.adams.junior@microsoft.com, Ross is out of luck. And finally, so why? Don't worry about writing these things down. We offer what we call the Office 365 Deployment Readiness Tool. And I can't stress enough, this is going to be your savior. This thing grovels your local Active Directory. It doesn't send info up to us. It's wholly contained in your on-prem deployment there. and it tells you everything that could possibly be wrong with the data in your directory that would cause you problems later on when you integrate with Office 365. Things like invalid UPN names. For one of the semantics of how sync works in Office 365 is, if you don't have a display name on a group, we won't sync it. Things like that are all captured by this deployment readiness tool. It is your way to get ahead of the curve, to get that full audit report of everything you might need to fix so that users are good to go. The last thing we want is for you to set up ADFS, set up DirSync, start running the thing, and say, OK, let's start onboarding users. And mailboxes don't show up in the cloud because they had duplicate proxy addresses or a bad UPN value. So please, please download this deck and run that tool as soon as you can to make sure you're good to go when you start your directory synchronization. The important thing here, and I've been asked this before, the DirSync tool is always picking up new stuff, right? It runs once every 3 hours. So if you do come across an error, you know, in the fullness of time, there suddenly becomes a bad value in proxy addresses, we'll tell you that. You'll get a notification saying, we couldn't do operation X, where operation X was, I'm trying to create a user. They have a bad proxy address. So you go and you fix that. The next time DirSync runs, it'll pick it up. So, you know, running the deployment readiness tool now means that you'll get ahead of all that. But as you are, you get these error reports, and as you correct the data, we'll pick up what we can and automatically fix that for you. A little bit into sort of the validations that we do for directory integration. First of all, the very most basic level, when a user is created in the Office 365 cloud or in Windows Azure AD, they're in an unlicensed state, meaning they just exist. They're just this username with a bunch of information about them. There's a couple validations that we apply right off the bat for those users. The first one is, you can't have duplicate proxy addresses. Ross and I cannot both be rossadams@microsoft.com. That conceptually makes sense, right? But because of the nature of the on-prem products that we have and the homegrown solutions and the line of business apps, anything's possible. So that's definitely one of the things that that deployment readiness tool I was talking about will help you get ahead of. Also, the SIP addresses must match a verified domain. Again, verified domain being one of the domains from that portal page where you've gone and taken actions to prove ownership of the domain. Why does that concept matter? Well, you don't want Microsoft using your domain for email addresses and vice versa. We don't want you using ours, right? So it's just it's a proof of ownership for all the services down the line. So at some point in time, after the user has been created, you want them to start using Exchange. You're going to go and license them. You're going to give them that Exchange license. At that point in time, we'll go and scrub the things that are important to us. We're going to scrub the proxy addresses in particular. We're going to go and remove any proxy address that isn't using a verified domain. And conceptually, that maps to, if you have a mailbox, I don't want you receiving mail for an email address you shouldn't really have, right? So that's what we're doing behind the scenes. Now, one thing to note is sometimes you've forgotten that you have one of your email domains, right? It's a mail.foo.bar.contoso.com. Just didn't click that you had to go and register that. That's not a problem. If you notice this is the case, you can go back and add that verified domain later. Behind the scenes, we'll automatically recalculate all the user's proxy addresses and get them into a good state as if you'd had that in the first place. Something else to note is DirSync. When it's running in its everyday form, we'll make sure that whatever is in your on-prem directory shows up in the cloud, including changes to your user principal name. This behavior changes once they've been licensed. That's really to make sure that the user doesn't suddenly fail login because they no longer know what the user principal name is. Put another way, DirSync will not automatically update user principal names for licensed users. You can still control that. You can change that using the PowerShell commandlets. As appropriate, but that's just something to note as well. And as the slide calls out, it will automatically update in cases when you're flipping over to use single sign-on. And the last bullet point I just talked about there around re-adding domains that have been missed. So conceptually, there's two ways that directory synchronization can work. The first is what we call sort of a one-way. It's moving your data from your on-prem directory up into the cloud. As per before, gridding this around a single place to manage my users, my contacts, and groups. This also means, though, that for the majority of those attributes on objects, it has to also be changed now on-prem. There is no cloud experience anymore. You can't have it both ways, right? You get one place to administer, but then you only have one place to administer. There's a second form of this, which we refer to as sort of a two-way sync. You'll hear terms like the hybrid deployment, write back. All of these things allude to the fact that a certain set of attributes are now pushed back on-prem. This is an option when you set up DirSync or any of our other directory synchronization solutions. You explicitly enable this. So by default, we never go and touch your on-prem AD. That is a design principle, so you can rest assured that that's the case. So why would you want two-way sync over one-way sync? Well, you need that two-way sync to get the hybrid deployment. The features I was talking about earlier, you can have Exchange Mailbox on-prem with all of your UM goodness and features lit up in the cloud. You can move users back and forth. I've migrated them up, a user up into Exchange Online, and they've changed departments, and their new department isn't in the cloud yet, so you can move them back down. Mail routing's preserved. There's a set of 7 attributes that we write back right now. All that's documented on the web for reference, but they're all focused primarily on Exchange. Tomorrow, as in the metaphorical tomorrow, it'll be for SharePoint and Link as well, not literally the 13th. The key takeaway here is you can start with one-way sync. When you set up your DirSync, just uncheck that box for hybrid deployments, and you're off for the races. You can step up to two-way sync, meaning you just reconfigure your box and say, now I want to have my hybrid deployment and light up those features. You can't move back to one-way sync. And I'll qualify that for you. You have to nuke the entire DirSync machine and reinstall completely from scratch to go back to one-way sync. That really has to do with the nature of what information is transported back and forth and how we retain that state for your synchronization process. And in the two-way sync, what's interesting is some of the attributes are now mastered in the cloud. Not mastered by you, but mastered by actions that your users take. They've made a configuration for their UM settings, or they've decided to retain a personal archive in the cloud. That action implicitly triggers information to be written back to your on-prem directory, so that user now has a seamless integration experience between on-prem and the cloud. By default, directory synchronization syncs almost everything. We don't sync your default accounts. We don't sync, for example, your administrators. We don't sync system objects. Those just aren't interesting, right? Directory synchronization is about provisioning meaningful directory data in the cloud. So users can log in, so users can send mail. They can ACL in SharePoint. They can assign resources in CRM online. That's the focus. So it doesn't do us any good to move your system information. Another question I've gotten before is, do you move stuff from my configuration OU up into the cloud? Well, no, we don't. Again, what we're focused on is getting that object information into the Azure AD that's useful for your cloud experience. Directory synchronization can be turned off. And I'm going to qualify that by saying, in the portal, when you're setting up directory sync, you actually say, activate directory synchronization for me. It's a back-end process that gets consensus with all of our services so that it's now ready to transfer ownership. Again, because you're going to be mastering your stuff on-prem, right? We're getting consensus and saying, okay, all this stuff is now going to be mastered on-prem. At some point, you get the green light, and your directory sync will start to work. You can turn that off. You can decide, you know what? I had directory synchronization. It was great. I populated my stuff. Don't really need it anymore. That's fine as well. You can deactivate directory sync. But again, there's that consensus process. We have to make sure everything in the cloud is ready to be mastered in your cloud environment. And that takes time. If you really want, you can go back and reactivate DuraSync again, but see previous two statements about what has to happen. DuraSync, for the most part, if we've done our job right, and I hope we have, it's a pretty self-sufficient appliance piece of software that just runs. You don't need to touch it a lot. We tell you if something's wrong. For example, hey, you'll get this email that says, I haven't seen you run DirSync in 24 hours. You go, well, I should have, because it should be running. So we know we tell you when something's not working right. We tell you when we can't sync things. And the whole idea is you don't have to worry about the thing. It will tell you when it needs attention. But it goes both ways, right? That also means that we have a very, very small set of configuration options for you. Most of them are exposed at configuration time. The config wizard walks you through and asks you for the things that you're going to need. There isn't a lot more beyond that. Some of the most common questions in the last year that have come up, so let's talk about them here, is, well, I don't want to sync all of the attributes you're syncing. I don't want to sync mobile phone, or I don't want to sync, choose your pick. Unfortunately, as it stands right now, that's not really an option for us. We need to sync all that information because, as it stands with the current design, any service is able to use that data for some workflow or some feature deep within there, and we can't afford to have those break. The last thing we want is for something to not light up in SharePoint because the mail attribute wasn't set correctly, or something within Exchange because we were missing a particular attribute. So scoping the set of attributes that can be synchronized, not currently supported. And by default, we synchronize once every 3 hours. To be a little bit clearer, DirSync sleeps for 3 hours between sync cycles. So it'll wake up, it'll ask AD, give me all the changes since the last time I asked you for all the changes, gets that data, pumps it to the cloud. The tail end of that, it goes to sleep for 3 hours, and it comes back up. It's not configurable, that's by default. That's the sweet spot we found for getting information up into the cloud across all of our tenants. And I'll hand this over to Ross.
Thanks, buddy. All right. So let's talk about the sign-in experience. So if I set up single sign-on, and pretty much the rest of us, I talk about single sign-on, John talks about directory sync. So we're going to follow through the single sign-on experience. So I go ahead, I deploy ADFS, I've got sync running. What sort of an experience do I get here? Okay. And we're going to break this into three parts. We're going to talk about rich clients and web clients, and then we'll talk specifically about Exchange. So if I look at sort of the rich client set, and the rich clients are those that use what we'll call the sign-in assistant, the Microsoft Online sign-in assistant, which is a service you install that comes with that Office desktop setup program. And basically, Link uses it, Office subscription services use it, CRMs online, the rich client from CRM use it, and other services are starting to use it as we move forward. What it offers, if I'm on a domain-joined machine on the corporate network, is pretty much an integrated enterprise single sign-on experience. I sign into my PC in the morning, I fire off Link, and in fact, this is my experience, my mailbox and Link and pretty much everything I use is now in the cloud. When I do that, I get this integrated experience. No prompts for credentials, it just signs in, Link fires off, opens up, signs me into the cloud, and I'm away. Very much like it would if I was on-premise. Okay. In this case, the client itself is actually doing, and we're going to go through this dance, but the client itself is doing the dance and talking to ADFS directly. Okay. When I'm off the corporate network, all right, my experience is slightly different. Okay. And it depends on the way that you configure your ADFS server. Okay. Depends on the endpoint you expose, but you may or may not get prompted for experience. So, for example, Microsoft allow us to connect to a Windows integrated endpoint externally, and I get a sign-in experience, which is seamless as well. Okay. If I have web-based applications, all right, so these are SharePoint Online, OWA, Office-rich applications. So in this case, Office 2010 or 2007. These applications, Word, PowerPoint, Excel, not Outlook, but Word, PowerPoint, Excel, Visio, those sorts of services that talk to SharePoint Online, generally throw a Trident window. Okay, and this Trident window is effectively a web browser window in the context of the Office applications. And it prompts for a username to do realm discovery. All right, and we'll walk through what realm discovery allows us to do. But effectively, it says, when I type my username in, it's very important. This is why we say everybody must have a UPN, is because when I type that UPN in, the identity system in the cloud says, ah, you're a federated user, and I can't actually authenticate you. But I know who can. And I get redirected to my on-premise ADFS server. And if I'm on the corporate network, on a domain-joined machine, I will effectively get challenged by the ADFS server, and I'll send my credentials and get an experience, a seamless experience from that point forward. So in the case there, I get prompted for username. Okay? Don't get prompted for my password, I get prompted for my username. And I can save that. There's a box that says keep me signed in, which effectively allows me to set a cookie that allows me to bypass that sign in, click here to sign in type experience. OK. okay? And in this case also, the client is making that connection. So if I'm external, I'm on a non-domain join machine, or sorry, on a domain join machine and I'm external, I'm going to hit the ADFS proxy. And the ADFS proxy, depending on its configuration, a lot of people go with forms-based auth, I'm going to get the prompt for username, I'm going to get to the ADFS server, the ADFS server is going to say, great, you're now with me, I need to authenticate you. And you can enter your username and password. And on the ADFS server, you have a choice. You can enter it as, you know, domain whack user or user at domain, whichever way you feel fine. ADFS can authenticate either way. And you can also go through what we call smart links here. So if you don't like that experience, you can create smart links. So you could create a smart link, mail.contoso.com, that effectively did a redirect, for example, to www.outlook.com/contoso.com. And what that smart link does is effectively, when the user is redirected to the authentication page, authentication platform to log in, there's an extra parameter that says, this person is from contoso.com. And the authentication platform does a lookup, says, oh, I see you're a federated namespace, and then just automatically redirects you to the ADFS server. Now, you can do the same thing for SharePoint. It's a little more complicated. It's not quite as simple. The problem with SharePoint and smart links is it works really well for the default page. Okay? It doesn't work for deep links. Okay? So if you send a link to somebody in an email document, I email a document to Jono, I get a deep link. So it's a link direct to that document. When I click on that, it's very difficult to make a smart link for it. Okay? So smart links are great for the sort of home experience, work very well in Exchange. SharePoint, a little trickier to bypass the actual prompt. Okay. So how does Exchange work? And you've noticed I've talked about it. Exchange does, and this is Exchange. So Exchange, what I call rich mail applications. So this is Outlook, IMAP, POP clients, ActiveSync, Entourage, anybody who basically doesn't use OWA. It's often referred to as Exchange Proxy Auth, and I'll show you how this works. But the net of it is that your Exchange online actually collects your credentials and proxies them to the ADFS server. And since Exchange is always remote, it runs in the cloud, you always need a proxy. So if you want to use Outlook, IMAP, ActiveSync, some rich email client with Exchange online, you will need a proxy. Okay. It's a very important part. We'll need proxy for Exchange Online if you want to use one of the rich applications. And again, it should be highly available, load balanced, just like your on-premise infrastructure. And in this case, you're going to get a prompt for both, username and password. Okay? There's a tick box. You can save it. Outlook gives you the option. Mobile phones, these types of things, are usually pretty dumb devices. They only understand username and password. Again, you can save it there. When they get prompted for username, users, and this is the reason that we say everybody should get a UPN, and the reason we say assign an explicit UPN is so that people remember it, because they're going to have to type it in here, okay? You can't do sort of domain whack user, so Contoso whack Rossa isn't going to work. You need to say ross@contoso.com, all right? You must enter the full UPN, and that's because it's going to do realm discovery as well. Okay, so it does the same thing as, and we're going to show you in a little minute, it does the same type of process for realm discovery to find the ADFS server endpoints. Okay. We do have, because this is all external, we've got feedback from customers that say, hey, I really want to be able to limit access so that people only on the corporate internet can get in. We have a number of client access filtering options, and I'll walk through these in a minute. So it's a bit of a summary. I'm not going to go through the whole slide, but as a bit of a summary here, if I have online identities, so these are identities that are mastered in the cloud, all right, or cloud-based identities, everything is an online identity, okay? I'm going to get prompted for my username and my password, okay? And it's going to be that username and password I have configured in the cloud. If I'm on a doing single sign-on and I'm on a non-domain join machine, it's going to be username and password for a number of these applications, because when I get challenged by ADFS, I can't send my credentials automatically. I effectively don't have them. Okay? But it is my AD credential that I'm sending. UPN username, okay, and my password. Right? But it's my AD credential. It's not a cloud identity. There's no synchronize. We don't know your idea, you know, your actual identity in the cloud. It's all done through your actual ADFS infrastructure. So it's a prompt, username and password, but it is your AD credential. And then if you're on a domain-joined machine on the corporate network, you can get through a pretty good experience with most, as I said, sort of those sign and assistant-based apps, and there's more of these coming. You can save the credentials and you'll get no prompts. Okay. Web clients, there is that sort of username to do realm discovery, and then click through, and then you'll end up with Exchange clients, username and password, and these are the rich Exchange clients. OWA falls into that web client category. So what are the details? How do we actually make all this stuff work? All right. So now we get into the sort of nitty-gritty of it. So our Azure AD or our online services scenarios require we use the WS Star protocol, so Federate and Trust, so WS Fed and WS Trust. And we require those because they support both types of clients for us. Effectively, the client that uses the web-based protocols and the clients that use the richer cloud protocol, so the active protocol as well as the MEX endpoint, the metadata exchange endpoint. And we require those for the rich set of applications. So if you want Link to work, you need to be a WS Star provider, for example. Okay. It is a 1-1 token, so we use WS Star with a SAML 1-1 token. And there's three kind of key elements we store in that token. All right. We store an issuer URI. And the issuer URI is effectively the way that we map your on-premise data that's coming back in the SAML token to the data that's in the cloud identity. So it's got to be globally unique. Okay. Across all tenants, across all namespaces, we need a single issuer URI. All right. And that's usually pretty straightforward. It's usually the domain name with some extra decoration around it, I'll call it. There's what we call the user source address. Okay. This is the unique, never-changing identifier of the user. And because we like to use the same words over and over again, we'll call it user source address, we'll call it source anchor, and we'll call it immutable ID. So Jono likes to call it source anchor. I like to call it immutable ID. But at the end of the day, this is the unique identifier. So if you're running directory sync, when Jono was walking through the provisioning path there where my little man was flying across the screen, when he got provisioned into the authentication platform, in the case of a federated user, we set an immutable ID on that user. Okay? And directory sync provisions it. And it's based on the AD object GUID, base64 encoded, if you use the standard DIRSync compliance. And when ADFS sends a token, it includes that same value. It takes the AD object GUID of the user, looks it up when the user authenticates, puts it in the token, and sends it through to the authentication platform. When these two things don't line up, the user can't log in. So using directory sync and ADFS together give you an instant match. We will guarantee a match between those things. And we also send the user principal name. Now, user principal names change, which is fine. Generally, DIRSync will catch up and get it through. When the user logs in, we also do an update in the authentication system. So UPN can change. All right. There is some restrictions on what changes we'll accept during login. For example, you can't change it to a new domain. That won't work. But if you're just updating the alias, so you know, if somebody changes their name and you update their email address and their corresponding UPN, that flows through automatically. But it is included in the token. So where do all these clients hit? As I said, we're using WS Star. We have sort of three endpoints here. This is for demonstration purposes only. If for those pure in the audience, it's a little different. So what we have here is effectively, if I draw a corporate boundary and I put my ADFS server out on that corporate boundary, and I have my ADFS server internally, you can see here clients like OWA, so these are web-based clients, or SharePoint, or Word, or Excel, talking to SharePoint Online, they'll all use the passive or web protocol endpoint. Okay, and they all talk to that particular endpoint. In the case of Link or Office Subscription Services, if they're on the internal network, they talk directly to the ADFS server. Okay? And in this case, when they talk directly to the ADFS server, they hit the MEX endpoint first, the metadata exchange endpoint. From there, they get a list of endpoints, and then they pick the endpoint they want. A lot of people choose a lot of our apps will choose the Windows integrated endpoint, and then they authenticate on that endpoint. Okay? If you're using Outlook, any variety, IMAP, POP clients, or if you have Active Sync clients, even if they're connected to the corporate wireless network, they all send their, effectively send their information externally to Exchange Online. Okay? And if they're external, they still send it to Exchange Online. And Exchange Online sends that back to us, and it adds some additional information. And the additional information it adds is very important. It allows us to do this filtering, which I'll talk about in a second. But they allow us to pass the client IP. So Exchange Online takes the external IP that hits it and adds it to the token, or the detailed information it sends to the active endpoint on the ADFS server. Okay? Right now, it's the only client that directly talks to the active endpoint. It'll also send the protocol. Okay? And in this case, when I say protocol, I mean the exchange protocol. So for example, there's an RPC endpoint. There's a AutoDiscover endpoint. There's a, what else have we got there? Active Sync endpoint. There's about 20-odd endpoints. I can't remember them all off the top of my head. But it'll send the endpoint that the client connected to. Okay? And then it'll also send the device string. Okay? So Outlook sends a device string. A lot of clients send a device string. So that you can use any one of these pieces of information, or all three of these pieces of information, to filter the access that client has. Okay? So if we look at OAuth and Link, as you can see, they still talk to the same endpoints when they're external, but they talk to the MEX endpoint or the web endpoint. All right. So what happens if I say, I really like this Office 365 stuff, it's all good for me, but I don't want it to work when the customer, or when users, or a set of users, are not on the corporate network? How many people would have a requirement on that? A couple? A few. Okay. So how do I do that? This is all very good. A, you need single sign-on. All right. So you need to get authentication in your control. Now that you've got authentication in your control, you can do a couple of different things. You can simply block all external access. Okay. And there's a link at the bottom here, and it talks you through and gives you the sample rules to do this. So you can block everything. I don't want any client to work anywhere. Okay. I can say, well, maybe I'll let some clients work externally, but not others. So Active Sync, I might decide was okay. I'll let Active Sync work remotely. Okay. I could say I'll let web clients work remotely. All right. So I want only my web clients to work. This does require an ADFS proxy. Okay. There's some special source that lives in the ADFS proxy that allows this to pass through. All right. Or I could say, you know, my execs, they're good. I trust them. Let them work remotely. But nobody else. Okay, and I'll just mention this. I'm pretty sure you can download these slides, so with the audio, I believe, at the end of it. So feel free. So when you turn on any one of these rules, it effectively doesn't give you any granularity of allowing or blocking the link or the sign-in assistant based applications. So effectively, if you add one of these rules, you block those clients. It is something we're looking at. But as it stands today, this is, you know, the limitation of this, if you like. All right. Now, you can use third-party proxies. There's a document that details what they require. But it requires that they're able to transform and pass through particular headers or add particular headers to it. And all of those scenarios above work, with the exception of the allow only web applications. It actually does have some special source in there. So what does it look like? How does this work? Who's familiar with the SAML ping pong? A couple? All right, so this will be good then. A lot of animation in these screens, but we're going to show you how it works. So what actually happens when I try and authenticate? And we're going to go through the passive, the web flow first, because it's kind of simple, all right? And we'll walk this through. So I'm on a domain join machine on the corporate network. What happens? I go off and I'm going to hit Exchange Online or SharePoint Online, and it's going to say, hey, before you can talk to me, you need to authenticate. And it gives me a URL. And the client says, thank you very much, and follows the URL and hits the authentication platform. And either the authentication platform will have some hint about where it's got to go, so if you did Outlook, WAC, contoso.com, or you've typed your username, it's going to say, ah, I see you're a federated user. I can't authenticate you. So you need to go to this link, and it'll give you another link. And the client gets that link and follows it. Now, there's a few extra bouncy balls in here that I haven't shown, but effectively, I get to the ADFS server now. And I'm going to be prompted for authentication, or challenged, if you will. So I'm going to get a 401, and if I'm on a domain join machine, corporate network, it's in my intranet sites, all things lined up, I'll send my credentials through to the ADFS server. The ADFS server will say, thank you very much. We'll go off to AD, and we'll do a lookup. All right? And it'll return some information, and it will put it in a token for me. And I'm going to call this a logon token. Okay? So it's a SAML 1.1 token. It's got the issuer URI in it, has my UPN, and has this source user ID. When I get that token, I get it back from the ADFS server. The client has it. It's been signed by the ADFS server, and I send it off to the authentication platform. And the authentication platform says, thanks very much, takes the issuer URI, looks up my domain, grabs the certificate, verifies that the signature on my token matches what's been allocated in the cloud, so my signing certificate. And then if all things line up, it'll do a search and say, can you find a user based on this source user ID or this immutable ID? And if it can, it'll give me an auth token. And it'll stuff the same stuff back into it. Now that authentication token comes back to me, and then I send it off to the service. And now I get access to my mail. Now the services in this model have no idea how you authenticated. They trust the authentication platform only. They will only work with an authentication, with a token that comes from the authentication platform. So what we've done is effectively converted your on-premise through a trust protocol up to the authentication platform to get that token so that Exchange knows how to map you. All right. So, now moving into the much better world, a lot more animation in this one. The MEX client, this is how the MEX endpoints work, or the rich clients. So I log into my machine. When I log into my machine, I type my username, my password, I hit enter. As soon as I do that, the sign-in assistant is a service. It's running in the background, and it detects the fact that a new user is authenticated. When that user authenticates, it actually does a lookup of the user's UPN. Now, it does a few little bits of magic. If it can't find one, it tries to take the SAM account name of the user, join it to the domain of the workstation, and says, that must be your UPN. This is another reason we say, set the user's UPN. That way, you get a deterministic flow. There's no made-up information. Then we're not trying to figure something out. Okay? So it's done this. It's looked up my UPN, and it sends my UPN up to the cloud, to the authentication platform, and says, do you know this UPN? And in this case, it says, sure, I know that UPN. It's federated. Sends back, hey, this is a federated namespace and all the endpoints that are available. The client then says, oh, I know how to handle that, and sends off to the ADFS server's MEX endpoint. Again, not all of the flows are in here. When I hit the MEX endpoint, I'm going to download the MEX document. From there, I'm going to pick the Windows Integrated Transport endpoint, and then I'm going to send a request to it. It's going to 401 me. I'm going to send back my credentials. All right. All things considered, I'm eventually going to get a logon token. And you'll notice this logon token is no different than the web logon token. Still signed, has the same contents. I get that back. I send it off. I convert. I now have a logon token. And this all happened while my machine was logging me in. All right. So in that first sort of 20 seconds of login or less, depending on network and other factors on the machine, I've now got this token. So Link, being a great service, fires off automatically on my machine. Link fires off. Link goes across to Link Online and says, hey, can I authenticate? And it says, no, you can't authenticate. You need to get a token from the authentication platform. And it just so happens the machine already has one. So the machine says, oh, I've already got one of those. How's this one look? And sends it across to Link Online. So when you fire Link off, Link doesn't have to do the ping pong. The ping pong has already happened. And it's a very similar flow to the passive flow, some extra little pieces. But effectively, now I've got my token and I can send it across to Link Online. So what happens when I fire off Exchange? Log into my machine, nothing happens. Now if the sign-in assistant's there, it will do this song and dance, but effectively it's negated in here because we don't use it. All right. So the client goes across, fires off Outlook. Outlook is going to go across to Exchange Online. Exchange Online says, need some credentials. And in this case, it's going to say basic credentials. Okay. It doesn't ask for any particular type of token. It's simply saying, you need to give me some basic credentials, username and password. And that gets sent back to Exchange Online, captured from the user, sent back to Exchange Online over a 443, over an SSL connection. All right. When those credentials arrive at Exchange, it can't use them. They're useless to Exchange. It needs a logon token, all right, from the authentication platform. So it creates a little shadow of you and proxies up to the authentication platform saying, I've got this UPN, do you know what to do with it? Now, if the authentication platform comes back and says, hey, this is a managed user, it sends both the username and password up there. If it comes back and says, hey, I know you, you're federated, what it does is it comes back with the active endpoint and it sends the basic credentials and the other information, the client's IP that hit it, the device string that came, and also the endpoint information. Sends that to the ADFS proxy. The proxy proxies it through to the back end with some extra bits, and the client authenticates the user. So in this case, ADFS server authenticates the user and does the lookup, and at the end of the day, will issue a token. It's the same token. It looks very similar. All right, it has the same contents. That goes back to Exchange Online. Exchange Online says, can't use that, no good to me. Sends it up to the authentication platform. Gets swapped out for an auth token. Comes back to Exchange Online and it says, ah, finally I got that auth token I needed. Takes that auth token, looks you up, gets your mailbox, drops you, and returns the data to the user. All right. So in this case, they proxied that authentication. So the dance with the ADFS server and the authentication platform is proxied by Exchange. Okay. So some what I'll call Rossisms, and these are really some facts and figures, if you will, about the way that we deal with particular Active Directory structures. All right. So Jono touched a little bit on this with these multi-forest parts. But if I have, there's certain requirements we have, and this is about verifying the domains and making sure it's right. In a lot of cases, matching domains. I have an internal domain name, contessa.com. It's what I use externally. It's how I'm known as contessa.com. And I want to make sure that when I get to the cloud, I want to make sure everything works. There's nothing fancy you have to do here with either directory sync or ADFS. All right? I use a subdomain. All right, so in the Microsoft case, we use corp.microsoft.com as our internal sort of root forest, and then we have a whole bunch of stuff off it. But if I use that structure, there's only thing that we need to do here is make sure we register things in the right order. So by default, when I register contessa.com, I'll have to prove I own it. So I'll create the DNS records and so on to prove I own it. When I register corp.contessa.com, and you don't have to use it for email, you can use it purely for UPNs, when I do that, it'll automatically verify, and it'll automatically inherit the state of the root domain. Okay. So in this case, if I have contessa.com, and that's what I use for email, and then I use corp.contessa.com, and then sales, and I have a whole bunch of different domains, I'm going to want to make sure I register contessa.com first. And when I do that and federate contessa.com, all domains underneath it will become federated, and my single ADFS server within that forest can handle all of those domains. All right? And no special source required. If I have a .local domain, how many people use .local or .internet or .ad or a few? All right. How many of you use smart cards, just out of interest, with a local domain? Oh, just one. We should talk afterwards. So there's a little bit of a problem there. You can't prove you own a .local or a .ad domain to us. All right, it's not going to work for you, all right, and that's because there's no publicly registrable DNS that allows us to do that. So, if you want to set up single sign-on, everybody needs to get a new UPN. And the reason I ask for smart cards is smart cards are generally issued to the UPN of the user, and if the UPN of the user is based off the domain, then they'll need to get new smart card certificates because the UPN is now wrong. All right. So really, if you use a .local, you don't have to change the name of your domain. And if you don't have smart cards, it's not too bad. You do need to give everybody a UPN that's going to match. And we suggest something like email address. But we can talk further. Oh, OK. You're good then. So that one is .local, new UPNs. And then if you have multiple UPN suffixes, so you have something like single Active Directory forest, a couple of these, single Active Directory forest, but you've got sort of top-level UPN suffixes, contessa.com, fabricam.com, those sorts of things. We originally said you have to have an ADFS server per domain. That went away sort of November of last year, so almost 12 months ago now. And we added a switch called support multiple domain. What that switch does is it allows us to configure the issuer URI based off the UPN of the user. So if you add a domain and you say support multiple domains, we'll configure the issue URI so that it sets the effectively the claim rule within ADFS. So when it sends it, when the user logs in, depending on what the UPN suffix is, we'll grab that and send it through. Now, if you have subdomains with that, we are working on updating the documentation, but it is possible. The default guidance doesn't support subdomains, but we can certainly walk you through how to do that. And then if you have multiple AD forests, as Jono said, talk to your TAM. They're the best way to get into that program, that early adopter program. And it's also true if you have non-AD sources. We're starting to work on an early adopter program for that as well. So I'm going to walk through strong authentication. I see we only have 9 minutes left, so I'm going to pick up the pace so we've got some time for questions. We took basically two approaches to this. The first approach was sort of, I'm going to only allow web-based applications. So I'm going to turn everything off externally. I'm going to turn web-based applications on, and I'm going to allow only for, don't care about rich clients, but I care about web clients only. The second scenario is really, I kind of want my rich clients to work, but I only want them to work when they're externally and they're going to VPN into me. All right, and that's how we can support the rich clients. So what does it look like? Web clients only. There's a couple of different models. Firstly, you can use smart cards straight out of the box if you've got them. ADFS supports smart cards out of the box, so you can use that if you wish. You can also customize ADFS, and there's two options here. You can have a third-party a third-party 2FA provider. We have an RSA example. If you use RSA, you can plug in the example. Or you can customize that forms logon page. All right? So you can either proxy the authentication back, or you can tack it onto the bottom. All right? And as I said, this is web clients only. So this is really taking the forms logon page and making it 2FA. No support for rich clients. So what does it look like? I'm trying to get to SharePoint. I access SharePoint, and it does the same song and dance. It says, no, you can't do that. Sends me off to the identity Azure Active Directory, if you will, or the identity system in the cloud. I type my username, I get redirected. Okay. ADFS out of the box says, hey, I've been told you can only use a smart card, so give me some smart card credentials. I give it the smart card credentials, I generate the token, I send it back, and I get access. All right. So it's very similar to the passive flow, except for in this case, I was challenged by forms-based auth externally to give me a smart card. So what happens when I'm doing something else? Some other 2FA provider. I've got two options. I have my 2FA service, and I tack a little bit more onto the ADFS proxy, so it understands how to do this 2FA. And as I said, we have that RSA example. So I go off, I access SharePoint, same sort of thing happens. I get redirected to the identity provider, in this case my ADFS server. It says, I need you to strongly authenticate against me. And this can either be a redirect, or in the case of a custom, it'll be within the ADFS proxy's forms logon page. I then present whatever strong credentials I have to the system. It authenticates me, it redirects me back to the ADFS server, who eventually authenticates the response and then sends me off to get a token. I go back, I get my other token, and so on. And I've got access to the application. Right. So this is the web flow. Oh, there we go. No rich clients. So if I actually want rich clients, I want these other clients to work, the way that we do that is to effectively say, well, pull them internal. Pull them into your internal network and away you go. So we integrate the 2FA into a VPN provider. All right. Then we use the client access filtering to control Outlook, because Outlook, unfortunately, is always external. So we can then control where Outlook can authenticate from. So we can say Outlook only works on the corporate network. So let's walk through the model. Firstly, both, there they go, both my phone or IMAP clients or any other client, they all send their credentials across to Exchange Proxy Auth. And we're going to effectively say, well, apply when that request comes back to us, the rules that say only allow Outlook to work when it's within the corporate boundary or whatever rule set I define around it. All right? And it's going to get tokens. Then what I can do is I say, well, I want my rich applications to work now. And they're external, so I'm sitting there in the cloud. What I'm going to do here is effectively say, I have a two-factor VPN. They authenticate through that VPN and connect to the internal network. So they really look like now they're on the internal network. And when they're on the internal network, they talk to the direct to the ADFS backend server, and therefore they get the tokens that they need. All right? So in this model, we're saying in order to get that sort of strong authentication for our rich clients, we've got to pull them back into the corporate network. Okay. So that brings us through to the end of this. We have 4.5 minutes. And we'll take as many questions as we can, and then we'll, Jono and I are around, so we'll go from there. FOPI and single sign-on, plans for that. So as FOPI gets integrated into the model, so it's actually a good leading question. So Azure Active Directory, as we add more services, well, they all begin to consume that same model. So as FOPI comes into it to be a service that's directly connected, you'll get that same experience with it.
Of course, with multiple UPN subs. Mm-hmm. Is there any issue if user in one domain has a UPN from the other domain?
So if you have a single forest, multiple domains, can you mix and match users? Yes, is the answer to that. So the global catalog has effectively where the user lives and will route them around correctly. So they don't have to do that. We should say that when you have multiple UPN suffixes, if they're all federated, you can't actually move directly from one federated domain to another. You have to pass through a tertiary domain, so some managed domain in the middle. All right, it's just a little bit of a nuance.
There's a question over there.
So if I have if I've got one forest and I've got like 80 domains in it, is there a scaling problem with that? And the answer is no. There's no additional scaling requirements when we have multiple UPN suffixes. And it's because we do it on the fly. It's a very simple transition that we do. So we do a single lookup in AD, we take the UPN, and then we do a reg expression effectively to issue the issuer URI from that. So the additional load is almost near zero. So if you had many thousands of domains, it wouldn't make a difference whether you had 2 or 10,000.
At the mic.
Yeah, why are you using the older SAML tokens?
SAML 1.1 tokens?
Yeah.
So WSStar is really, the token format doesn't make a great deal of difference. If we move to a SAML 2 token, it's not that much different. You're probably heading towards when are we going to support SAML 2, SAML P protocol?
Right.
So SAML P is under investigation. So we are working through that again. It has some limitations, and that's where we err on the side of saying rich clients is what we want to make sure we support broadly across. So there's SAML P has some requirements. It's effectively only passive, although certain do support active, but there's no MEX endpoint. And the MEX endpoint is what we really need for those rich clients to actually authenticate correctly.
Thanks.
In your topology model, you have proxy out of the DMZ. Have you been able to publish anything from TMG or anything
like that to avoid prevention? So effectively the question is third-party proxy support, so replacing the ADFS proxy with something else. So there was a link in here where I talked about alternative proxies, and we have some requirements on them. We are working on the TMG. TMG allows us to do certain things. It doesn't allow for the external client access filtering unless you add custom code to TMG to add the additional headers. It's a bit tricky. And we are working on the UAG story as well. Okay. UAG does some interesting things today, and that's why we technically don't support UAG as it stands, but we are working with the UAG team to fix some of that. So the best bet, have a look at that article. It'll tell you what you need from a proxy in order to be able to support it with ADFS. And it depends on if you're trying to do the client access filtering, that adds additional requirements. If you're not, then most, you know, sort of, you know, proxies have some capability. What would I do with what, sorry? Oh, what would you do with multi-forest? If you had the same sort of thing, multiple forests with a... we didn't put this in here. So ADFS as it stands, so DirSync's a little different on the way it deals with multi-forest, but ADFS from a multi-forest perspective is really talking about the way where the user authenticates, okay? So if you have... 20 forests, and they all have trusts, you could get away with one ADFS server or one ADFS farm, okay? If you had 20 forests and they had no trusts, you would need 20 farms, all right? So it's really about the trust model that comes into the way that ADFS works. And it's probably, John and I are going to head down to the Office 365 little orange booth thing downstairs. If you want to, you can come down and we can certainly draw some pictures for that, the way that ADFS would work.
And
in that
model. We roll out support for multi-forest, like I was saying, right now it's through Microsoft Premier deployment only, but as we make it generally available, all that type of guidance, you know, topology information will be available, definitely, yep. In terms of how to accomplish your goals. Mm-hmm. Yep. At the mic.
Yeah, we're looking at Office 365, and one of the concerns that we have is when it comes to setting up your ADFS infrastructure. If your on-premise authentication, right, your AD, ADFS infrastructure is down, obviously all your users in the cloud, you know, cannot authenticate. So we're looking at, okay, what would be the model then? Do we have to set up a separate AD, ADFS infrastructure outside of our environment, maybe potentially hosted or somewhere out of region? I mean, just talking about guidance and maybe we'll talk after in your whiteboard there.
Yeah, so it's really about the DR story for ADFS when it goes down. And we are looking at a number of different options around providing a couple of different fallbacks. All right. I don't know. Dean Wells is doing a session on putting AD in the cloud on Azure infrastructure as a service. It's potentially an option. All right. It does require everything to be there, though. You obviously need your AD, ADFS infrastructure up there. And that's controlled by the customer. We are looking at alternative options where we can make that experience better for you. All right.
So I guess for now, a lot of customers are just relying as potentially a single point on-prem?
We have a number. So it depends on the size of the organization, whether you roll. I mean, to give you an example, Microsoft have 5 servers in a farm, all right, which supports all of Microsoft's ADFS requirements. And we run one here, or one in the US, in Redmond, I guess. And one in Dublin, okay? So we have a redundancy, and either one can service the planet. So we have redundancy for that. It depends on the size of your organization. I know some organizations say, I'm small, I want ADFS, I'm in a hurricane zone, and I need to have a data center somewhere else, which makes it prohibitively expensive. All right. So it comes back to what the requirements are. What we're trying to do is address the sort of spectrum of, you know, people like Microsoft who use ADFS, we have about 600-odd business-to-business type relationships. We're going to have it on-premise. We're going to continue to run it in high availability. But then there's the smaller organizations who are doing it for Office 365. How can we give them a better DR story that allows them, when it goes down, to fall back to something, all right, without having, you know, the expense of it?
Yeah, funny you mentioned the hurricane zone. I'm obviously South Florida, so... Mm-hmm. University of Miami, so we're definitely, that's important to us.
Perfect.
Yep.
Yeah, we just recently stood up AFS and Link Online working.
Mm-hmm.
It's working great. Appreciate it, love the product. But we're trying to look beyond the 365. We've got customer interest in products like Yammer, for example, that follow the same standard. How would we leverage AFS? Something that we could plug into leverage ADFS to provide that same
So I think it's almost a pure ADFS question. And Lou's sitting in the audience over there, so she'll correct me where I get this wrong. So ADFS as itself supports both WS Star as well as SAML 2, all right? And there's nothing that says you can't use it with other providers, okay? So if, for example, you found a SAML 2 provider, and I'm not sure if the one you mentioned is SAML 2 or not, but if it was, there would be nothing stopping you. Now, as we offer kind of, I guess with Office 365, as we said, there's two parts. There's the provisioning, so getting the user into the cloud, getting them into the identity system, telling them about the, you know, the way that the user works and linking them back together, and then ADFS providing the authentication piece. And you really need those two pieces to get a true directory integration. So it's a problematic area for third parties. All right? And what Stuart was talking about earlier, if you look for Stuart Kwan's session, which was Monday, it's recorded, but what he was talking about was effectively saying, I have AD on-premise, and I can create these one-off trusts. Or if I federate up into the cloud and you set up DirSync and ADFS to get to Azure Active Directory, can I use, you know, a trust relationship, some sort of OAuth or some other model to get to a third party? Can I effectively say to the third party, I'm not going to trust you, all of you, because that's too much to manage. I'm going to allow you to work with my identities and the stuff I've already provisioned into Azure Active Directory. So have a look at his. It may fall better into the category. There'll be more standards around that than the way that we would, you know. There's nothing stopping you doing it with ADFS Direct, but, you know, potentially you can avoid some of that pain if you go, instead of creating these different disparate, you know, sort of trusts across all these different partners, you could potentially leverage Azure Active Directory as a sort of central place. I federate from there. My apps then, you know, the applications then support the others, and I force them down that path. So Stuart's session,
Kwan,
I don't know.
It was yesterday, a lap around Active Directory. Azure Active Directory.
Which one's that one?
Which is not on this list. It was
so
yesterday.
So while he's talking, I will find it. It was on Monday. It was at some point in the day. Would you believe me? It was actually on.
It did actually happen. I swear we're not.
I was there.
209. It was 209. SIA 209.
Oh, sorry. Say that again, Ed.
SIA 209.
There we go.
There you are.
209. Perfect. Any other questions? Well, I think they're going to kick us out. I can see them.
She's inching closer
getting ready.
And closer.
Yeah.
That's the hint.
She's giving us the eagle eye.
All right. Thanks a lot, you guys.
Thank you. And we'll, as we said, we'll be downstairs if you've got more questions. Thanks very much.